Masechet Baba Kama Daf Pe Chet. The Mishnah mentioned the law, HaChobel Be'ayved Kena'ani Shel Acharim Hayav. If someone causes an injury to an Eved Kena'ani that belongs to someone else, he has to pay all five categories of compensation. However, the Biuda disagreed. He agreed on four, but he said the Eved Kena'ani is not does not have humiliation. The laws of humiliation do not apply, so he only has to pay the other four. So now we're going to look for the source of this machloket. My tamad the Biuda. From where does Rabbi Yehuda know that the laws of embarrassment do not apply to an Eved Kena'ani? Amar kera ki nasu anashim yachadav ish ve'achiv. So it's from this pasuk, when two men are fighting, this is the source for payment of embarrassment. When two men are fighting and a woman intervenes and grabs onto privates, that causes embarrassment, and she has to pay. Cut off the hand doesn't mean literally, but rather payment. Now, in this pasuk, when it says, ish ve'achi b'mi sheyesh lo achva, yasa'evit she'en lo achva, since it describes the two men fighting as a man and his brother, it means that payment is only given to someone who is involved in brotherhood, but not an Eved Kena'ani who is not involved in brotherhood. This could mean that an Eved Kena'ani cannot marry into Kahal Israel, so he doesn't have brotherhood with the Jewish people. Even though an Eved Kena'ani is half of a convert, he already has to do Brit Milah and is obligated in mitzvot, the same mitzvot that a woman is obligated in, but not until he's free is he a full convert. So at this point, he is not yet marriageable, he's not yet part of the Kahal, so he's not part of the brotherhood, and therefore does not receive this payment. Okay, that's Yehuda's source. V'rabanan, achiv hu b'misvot. But the rabbis disagree and say, and Eved Kena'ani does have brotherhood. After all, he has to perform most of the misvot, and so therefore it is called ish v'achiv, does apply to an Eved Kena'ani. So that's the machloket. When we say achiv, brotherhood, Rabbi Yehuda says that does not apply to Eved Kena'ani, and Rabbanan says it does. Now we're going to look at some other contexts, that other laws in the Torah that also mention brotherhood, and wonder about those. According to you, Rabbi Yehuda, that Eved Kena'ani is not called brotherhood. If someone, if two people are conspiring witnesses, Edim Zomimin, and they accuse an Eved Kena'ani of doing something that would require capital punishment, and it turns out that they were not there and could not have seen it, so then they would, the Edim Zomin would not get capital punishment themselves, even though normally if they accused a regular Jew, they would, because you only do to them as they try to do le'achiv, only if they accuse someone in brotherhood. But an Eved Kena'ani is not part of brotherhood, and therefore they would not get punished. Would you say that? But nobody thinks that. So Rav Sheshat explains that the pasuk of Edim Zomin also says you have to get rid of the evil in your midst. You can't have these false witnesses. They have to be deterred. And therefore, we will give a punishment no matter what. So this is an inclusive term that says, you're right, even though technically Eved Kena'ani is not part of brotherhood, nevertheless, you would kill those conspiring witnesses, so Rabbi Yehuda has a different source. Now a question to Rabbanan, who says Eved Kena'ani is part of brotherhood. Does that mean that an Eved Kena'ani can be a king? Because, right, it says, Mikedev Achecha, Som Tasim Alecha, Melech, Mikedev Achecha, you have to pick a king from among your brethren. So, Eved Kena'ani is part of a brotherhood, so that means he could be a king. Nobody thinks that. Amri Utaam Yichtikshilach Ger, the Dibri HaKol. So, Rabbanan can answer to them, wait, according to you, what about a convert? The law is a convert also cannot be a king, has to be a natural born citizen, like the president of the U.S. But according to you, I mean, again, a convert, everyone agrees is part of brotherhood. No one would disagree with that. Rather, we're learning from the mikedev achecha, from among your brethren. In other words, you can't just pick anyone who is involved in brotherhood, but only a select choice among them, from the finest, meaning from the highest class, and not from a convert, and therefore certainly not from an Eved Ivri. So again, Rabbanan, who thinks that Eved Kenani is in brotherhood, but for king, there's another pasuk that would exclude them. Ela me'at ha-rabanan yehe abed kasher la'aydu tichtiv, v'nei ayet sheker ha'ayet, sheker an ha-be'achiv. Another question, Rabbanan, who say Eved Kenani is defined as brotherhood, does that mean an Eved can be as kosher to testify, to give testimony? Because after the pasuk says, behold, there was a false witness, someone testified falsely against his brother. So that means that, you're not allowed to testify falsely. But the point is that there is testimony as long as someone is called a brother. And you said Eved Kenani is called a brother. So that means Eved Kenani can testify, but that's not the law. Amar Ula, Eidut Lamasit Amart Atya, Eidut Bekavachomer Me'isha. So Ula says, no, in fact, Eved Kenani cannot be a witness. And we know that from the derivation of testimony in general, because we learn the laws of testimony from a kavachomer, from a woman. Uma isha shei ruya lavo b'kahal pasula la'edut, eved sheino ruya lavo b'kahal, eino din shepasul la'edut. In other words, even though we have this pasuk that says testimonies for brethren, for an Eved Kenani, we could learn that they would be excluded from the following Kal Vachomer. If a woman who can marry, a regular woman can marry into the Jewish community, and yet women cannot generally give testimony for most things, so an Eved Kenani who cannot marry into the community, all the more so, they will be excluded from being a witness. So we learn from a Kal Vachomer that they're out, and therefore Rabbanan can rely on that Kal Vachomer. Then we counter the Kal Vachomer. Hold on, but a woman is not involved in the law of circumcision. So that maybe that's connected to why she cannot testify. Should we apply the same to an Eved Kenani who does get a Brit Milah? So maybe it's a different category. But then we answer, Katan Yochich, Sheyeshna B'Milah, Pasul Ha'edut. Well, a minor Jewish boy, the laws of circumcision do apply to him, and yet a minor cannot testify. So therefore, it's irrelevant whether someone is obligated in circumcision or not. So that now the Kal Vachomer is good. But then we challenge the Kal Vachomer again. But a minor is not responsible to do commandments. And Eved Kenani is responsible to do most of the commandments. But then we could bring in a woman who also are obligated in most misvot and yet cannot testify. So you see that's not a relevant factor. So therefore we can prop up the Kal Vachomer by bringing all the both together. V'chazar hadin, lo ri'ize kiri'ize, v'lo ri'ize kiri'ize, hasad asher shebehen sheken enan b'chol ha-mitzvot u'pesulin la'id, af ani abi et ha'ebet she'eno b'chol mitzvot u'pesul la'id. And so we'll come back to the beginning. And we know that the case of woman is not the same as that of a minor, and that of a minor is not the same as that of a woman, but there's a common denominator between them, and that cancels out the particular differences that each of them have. The common denominator is that both minors and women do not have to do all mitzvot. Minors don't have to do any. Women don't have to do mitzvot asher shazman gerama. And so they don't have to do all mitzvot, and they cannot testify. So too, my Eved Kenani does not have to do all the mitzvot, and therefore also cannot testify. So the Kal Vachomer is good. But then we challenge, there's a problem, because there's also a common denominator between women and minors that they are not adult males. And so, but Eved Ivri is an adult male. And so maybe Eved Ivri should be able to testify because he has that in common with adult men that he's also an adult male. And so we cannot bring Kal Vachomer from those two. Ela Teti, so that's rejected. Ela Teti Me Gazlan. Rather, we're going to bring the Kal Vachomer from a thief. The Kal Vachomer from a thief would be that he is an adult male and cannot testify. Someone who's a rasha, who does any major sin, cannot testify. So a gazlan cannot testify, and he's an adult male. And so too, an Eved Ivri, who is an adult male, and cannot testify. But then we reject that because a gazlan did something wrong. It's his actions that caused him to be now called a rasha. But Eved Ivri, he didn't do anything wrong that should make him disqualified from testifying. So that's not a good kal vachomer either. Elam tetem a gazlan umechad mehanach. Rather, we're going to bring together the thief and either one of the categories before, a woman or a minor. And if we bring them all together, we see what the common denominator is, that they are not doing all the mitzvot. Now, woman and a minor is because they're not obligated to do the mitzvot, and a thief because he violated one of the mitzvot. But either way, the fact that they are not or cannot do all the mitzvot makes them disqualified. And it doesn't matter if it's an adult male or not, or involved in circumcision or not. These categories together overlap and therefore cancel out any of the particulars. And so this is a good kal vachomer if we bring gazlan and one either a minor or a woman, we can learn a kal vachomer that in fact Eved Kenani cannot testify. And so therefore, since Rabbanan have this kal vachomer, they can answer the challenge, even though it says brethren regarding testimony. Eved Kenani Eved Kenani generally is part of brotherhood for Rabbanan. Still, from this kal vachomer, we learn that they cannot testify. That's one derivation, that Eved Kenani cannot testify. Now we have another. Mor b'ret Ravina amar kera lo yimetu avot al banim, lo yimetu al pi avot she'en lahem hayis banim. From this pasuk, lo yimetu avot al banim, that fathers should not die for the sins of the sons, the simple reading of that pasuk is that every person, if one sin, they are guilty. You don't have vicarious punishment and punish a son for a father or father for a son, which was done in the olden days, like in the Hammurabi Code. If a father was a contractor and built a building and it fell down and killed the owner's son, then you kill the contractor's son, like the sons are property. So Torah says, no, sons are not like property, and everybody gets their own punishment. That's the simple Peshat, and that's true. But the rabbis learn other laws from it. The basic law that we learn from this pasuk is that a father cannot give testimony for a son, nor a son give testimony to implicate a father. So imutu avot al banim, a father cannot get capital punishment because a son came and said, I saw my father do this sin. So close relatives, we learn from here, are disqualified from being witnesses. That's the basic thing that we learn from here that everybody agrees with. But now we're going to learn something additional. Lo yimetu al pi avot shen hem chayis banim. And no one can get the death penalty based on testimony of a person who is a father but has no relation to his sons. That is an Eved Kenani. An Eved Kenani, the master matches him up with someone and has children. Those children belong to the master, and they do not belong. They have no legal relationship to their own children. So that's what this means, and therefore, so why not? Because they do not have a relationship with their children, then they cannot testify about anybody, not only about their children, they can't be witnesses at all. Now, how do you know that you can apply this pasuk to that teaching? Because if it was only teaching one law, the basic law that children cannot testify against their fathers, then it should have added a suffix, the pronominal suffix, that fathers cannot get the death penalty on the basis of the testimony of their children. My banim, why are you generalizing it to all children? So this is coming to teach an additional law. It's not replacing the basic law that relatives cannot testify. It's adding an additional law that someone who is not related to his children, meaning an Eved Kenani, cannot give testimony at all. We challenge it. Ela ma'ata ubanim lo yimetu al avot. The continuation of the pasuk, what are you going to do with that? That children should not die on the basis of testimony of their father. Hachaname lo yimetu al pi banim shen lahem chayis avot. Ela ger hachinami de pasul le'aidut. According to that, you're going to learn that someone who is not related to their father also cannot testify. That would apply to a convert, right? Once someone converts, they are not related to their parents. A convert, after he converts and has children, is fully Jewish afterwards and will be related to their children. that they have after they convert, but they are not related to their parents. So therefore, according to this same logic, would you say that converts cannot testify? But that's not true. But according to your methodology, then you would come to that conclusion. So we answer, Amrei hachi hashta, ger nehi de'en lo chayis lema'la, lemata yesh lo chayis, lapuke aibe de'en lo chayis, lo lema'la ve'lo lemata. No, but a convert is different because he only has no legal relationship, family relationships going back a generation, but he is related to his children. So that excludes an Eved Kanani who has no relationship, not with his parents and not with his children. That's the only thing that this pasuk is excluding. Because if you would think that a convert, we're further explaining what we just said, if you think that a convert cannot give testimony, and that's what the Torah wanted to teach, then the Torah would have formulated the pasuk differently. So then it would have said in the first half that fathers cannot be killed based on testimony of their children, and that would teach us only the basic law that of relatives that can't testify about each other. That's the basic law, that fathers will not die because of testimony of their children. And then the continuation of the pasuk should say, if you wanted to teach that converts cannot testify, then the second of pasuk would use the general banim loy metu al avot, not avotehem, but all fathers. Deshmat mina tere echad al metu banim beedut avot, because that would teach us two things. One is the basic law that sons will not die because of testimony of their fathers, because they're relatives. V'yidach loy metu al pi banim she'en lahem chayis avot. And second, nobody can get capital punishment based on testimony of sons who are not related to their fathers, meaning converts. So I could have the first half of the pasuk give me the basic law. The second half of the pasuk should have said, the first half of the pasuk would have had the extra, the pronominal suffix, because it's only teaching one law. The second half of the pasuk would teach the more general without the pronominal suffix and teach two laws. And then once I know convert, I could use that as a basis of a kal v'chomer. Ve'ebed nafkale be'kal v'chomer miged. U'ma'ged de'lema'la hu de'en lo chayis, aval lemata yesh lo chayis, pasul le'edut. Ebed she'en lo chayis, lo lema'la v'lo lemata, en odin she'yeh pasul le'edut. And we can learn that an Eved Kana'ani cannot testify from a kal v'chomer of a convert. If a convert who is not related to his parents, his biological parents, but is related downwards to his children, and yet cannot testify, then Eved Kanani, who has no legal relationships, not with a generation before, nor with his generation after him, all the more so, cannot be a kosher witness. So if, in other words, if the Torah really wanted to teach that converts cannot testify, then it would have said the pasuk in that way. Ela midichatav rachamana lo imetu avot al banim, demashma lo imetu al pi avot she'en lo chayis banim, shenama mina evit she'en lo chayim, chayis lo lemal v'lo lemata, hu debasur le'edut, aval ger, kevan, deyesh lo chayis lemata, kasher le'edut. But from the fact that the Torah, in the first half of the pasuk, said that fathers cannot die because of sons, and it doesn't say benehem, it says banim, the more general, and therefore we learn from that no one can die because of testimony of fathers who have no relationship to their children, which is an Eved Kana'ani. So we learn from here that an Eved Kana'ani, who has no relationship, not generation before or after, that's only he is disqualified to give testimony. But since the Torah goes out of its way and teaches it in that case, so I know that it does not apply to a convert, because since a convert does have a relationship with his sons, therefore he is not the same as the one as Eved Kanani and can in fact give testimony. And now you're going to ask, how come in the second half of the pasuk, since we're not learning this law for a convert, how come the second half of the pasuk doesn't use the more particular pronominal suffix and say that sons cannot die because of their fathers, in which case we would learn only the basic law of relatives and not learn anything about ged? And then that would make the most sense. Lama li dichtav rechamana banim lo yimetu alavot. Hakam uses the general that that sons cannot die for fathers in general, in which case we might learn that converts should be out. The mashma lo yimetu al pi banim she'en lahem chayis avot, because that implies that one, no one can get the capital punishment for from someone who is a son who is not related to the father, meaning to converts. So this is kind of misleading pasuk. And the answer is, I did the chatav lo yimetu avot al banim, katav name, banim lo yimetu al avot. Since in the first half of the pasuk, it used the more general category, banim, and not binahem, and it had to do that in the first half of the pasuk because it needed to teach about Eved Kena'ani. So too, the Torah, for stylistic parallelism, continued and said, banim lo yimetu al avot, and not avotehem, because that would be a mismatch, and so avot in general. Even though the thing that you might derive from avot, that the secondary law about get, is not true, nevertheless, the Torah, for stylistic reasons, left it as avot and not avotehem. This is a very important Gemara because we see, we know this Aide de Katav, that argument of Aide is applied many, many times for Mishnah, that the Mishnah sometimes is very particular and uses an exact word to so we can infer something. And sometimes we say about the Mishnah, often, we say that this is just for stylistic parallelism. It's more rare that we apply this to a pasuk. Usually, we think a pasuk is, the wording is precise and very exact, but here, the Gemara is willing to say that the pasuk also, pisukim also, sometimes, are written in a stylistic way, and one cannot derive a law from that particular anomaly. Okay, the Mishnah continues, says, Cheresh, Shoteh, V'Katan, Pigiatan, Ra'ah. It's always bad to be involved in an injury situation with a deaf person, someone who's not mentally competent, and a minor, because if you damage them, then you will be liable. If they damage you, you will not be liable. So you're always at a disadvantage. Imed Rav Shmuel bar Abba mehag Ronya havat nesi bale l'Rabbi Abba katabin hu l'nichse l'Rav Shmuel bar Abba berah. Now we have a story. The mother of Rav Shmuel bar Abba from Hagronya, she got married to Rabbi Abba. Now, she had some property that she owned from before the marriage, and she wanted to make sure that should she die before her husband, that the husband would not inherit it. Normally, husbands inherit their wives, but she didn't want him to inherit, so she wrote a document saying that her property should be transferred to Rav Shmuel bar Abba, her son. She had a son from a previous marriage. Okay. So this is, just to get the name straight, is the mother of Rav Shmuel writes a document saying that Rav Shmuel should get this money and not Rabbi Abba, should get this property and not Rabbi Abba, her husband. Now, Batar de Shechiva, sure enough, she dies. Azal Rav Shmuel bar Abba, Kamed Rabbi Yirmiyah bar Abba. The son, Rav Shmuel, wants to make sure he can collect his property. So he goes to Rabbi Yirmiyah bar Abba to adjudicate the matter. Ukmeh b'nichseh, Rabbi Yirmiyah sees the document and said, I see, your mother transferred property, this property over to you, therefore it's yours. Okay, you can go and take it. Azal Rabbi Abba amara l'milta kamed Rav Hoshaya. But Rabbi Abba, the husband, he was not happy with this. He thought he was going to inherit this property, and he thought he had a right to it. So he took the matter to Rav Hoshaya, and this was a difficult matter. So Rav Hoshaya amara l'kamed Rav Yehuda. And Rav Hoshaya went and consulted with Rav Yehuda. They brought up the ladder. Amar le'achi amar Shmuel, ha'isha shemachrav b'nichse melog b'chaye ba'ala u'meta. Haba'al Mosi miyad halakohot, and Rabbi Yehuda said, in the name of the early Amora Shmuel, if a woman sells property that she brings into the marriage, if she brings property into the marriage, the husband enjoys the fruit. He takes the fruit all the time that they are married. And then, at the end of marriage, she gets that land back. Nichse melog means she gets the land back as is, in whatever state it is, whether it got better or worse, as opposed to nichse son barzel, where the husband guarantees a certain price for it. So this is her land that she owns, and if she tries to sell the land while she's married, while the husband is alive, and then she dies, that sale is invalid because the husband has a right to inherit her. Therefore, he already has a right at that time, and he can go to that buyer and say, "Sorry, I have a prior right to the land," and he can take the land from them. So, too, if we apply that here, the mother has land that the husband deserves. Rabbi Abba deserves it because he is going to inherit. Now, she basically wrote a document transferring it to her son. That's the same as a wife selling her land to someone else, and that sale is invalid. And therefore, Rav Yehuda told Rabbi Abba, "You have a right to the land. You can go and take it from Rav Shmuel." Amaru hakamed Rabbi Yirmiya bar Abba. So now this matter went back to the first judge, Rabbi Yirmiya, who did grant the land to the son, Rav Shmuel. Amar lehu ana matnita yadana, and Rabbi Yirmiya defended his first judgment, giving it to his son, based on a Mishnah in Masechet Baba Batra, Ditnan. Hakotev nechasav libno leachar moto, haben eno yachol limkor mipnei shehen birshut ha'av. והאב אינו יכול למכור מפני שאין כתובין לבן. מחר האב מכורים עד שימות, מחר הבן אין לו ללוקח עד שימות האב. The Mishnah teaches that if someone writes a document giving ownership of a piece of land to his son, and the transfer should be from now, but the father wants to keep the right to take the fruit while he's alive. So he wants to kind of transfer it while he's alive right now, but still, you know, live there and take the produce. So that the full transfer of the rights to the land will only happen after his death. So this is a kind of in between. What do we consider this transfer? Does it make sense to transfer ownership of land even though the seller, the original owner, is still using it? So in this case, the law is as follows. The son has no right to sell it while the father is alive because it's in the property, it's in the possession of the father. So even though the father did say, "Okay, I'm transferring it to you, my son," but the son doesn't have a right to use it yet, and therefore the son cannot sell it. The father also cannot sell it because he already wrote a document of transfer to the son. So neither party can sell it because neither has full ownership usage over it. Now, let's say the father does sell it to someone else. So that sale is valid while the father is alive, only to the extent that the receiver, the buyer, can use the land and enjoy its produce while the father is alive. So it's a kind of a temporary sale. But then once the father dies, then that transfer that he had initiated beforehand, it becomes completed, and the father no longer has the rights to the produce. So therefore, that buyer no longer has rights to the produce. And the son comes and takes the land and uses it fully. So yeah, the father, in other words, the father really cannot sell it. If he does go through a sale, it'll be a kind of temporary sale, kind of like a rental. Now, if the son sells it while the father is alive, now the son, he has ownership rights but no usage rights. The father is there taking the produce, so therefore the buyer cannot come and take the land while the father is alive. But once the father dies, then the transfer is totally complete. Even the usage goes to the son, and since the son had already sold it to that buyer, then it goes directly to the buyer. That's what the Mishnah said. Now, ki mayit av mi ha'it le lalokeach v'af agav demet ha'aben b'chaye av de'lo atu lidei ha'ben. We can infer, and this is how Rabbi Yirmiyah, he quoted this Mishnah to prove his point. So he's inferring from the last line here that once the father dies, then the sale of the son ends up going through and is perfectly fine. And, according to the Bimeya's reading, it doesn't matter who dies first. Even if the son dies first, while the father is alive, as such that the land never actually got it fully into the hands of the son, nevertheless, the sale is valid. In other words, the father and son are both alive. The father says, here, I'm transferring this land to you right from now, but I'm going to take the produce and use it and live on it all the time while I am alive. The son then goes and sells it to someone else. Now, it's not fully in the hands of the son, so that buyer is just waiting around. The son dies. Then afterwards, the father dies. That sale is valid because the son, even though he wasn't using the fruit, did have ownership of the land. And so therefore that ownership is recognized. And once the father dies, that sale is completed and the buyer can come and take it. That's how the Bimia is reading this. This is important because there's a parallel here to our case. In our case, the husband is like the father because the husband is enjoying the produce all the time of the marriage. He doesn't own the land. The mother retains ownership of the land, but he enjoys the produce. So the husband is like the father. The mother, in our case, Ibiyah's case, is like the son, because the mother owns the land, but does not have access to the produce. And the son, in our case of Ibiyah, Dav Shemuel, right, he is like the buyer, in the sense that the mother is transferring to her son while her husband is alive. So the husband is enjoying the fruit. She owns the land. She says, I'm going to transfer it to you, my son, from now. But then she died while the husband is alive. Ibrahimiyah says, this is the exact same case as the Mishnah, just like in the Mishnah. Even if the son dies first, since the son transferred it while he was alive, once the father dies, then it fully goes to the buyer. So too, the same thing here, since the mother transferred this piece of land to her son, even though the husband is using the fruit, doesn't matter, the ownership is, the main point of ownership is the one who owns it, not the one who is using the fruit, and therefore the sale is valid. That's Bimia's proof. Now to understand this proof, we're going to explain this Mishnah more fully. Kidrabi Shimon ben Lakish, and we're assuming the opinion of Resh Lakish. De'amar lo shena met ha-ben b'chayi ha'av de'lo atu lidei ha-ben de'ben de'lo shena met ha'av b'chayi ha-ben de'atu lidei de'ben kana lokeach. Resh Lakish interprets it, or Yibimiyah is interpreting this Mishnah the same as Resh Lakish did, who says that it doesn't matter who dies first. Whether the son dies first while the father is alive, such that the property never went fully into the hands of the son because the father was using it the whole time. And it doesn't matter whether the father died first, in which case the land did totally go into the hands of the son. Either way, the sale of the son to that buyer is valid and goes through. De'itmar. Here's the full background of the machloket that Shakish was arguing with Rabbi Yochanan about this. If the son sold it while the father was alive, but then the son died while the father was alive, Rabbi Yochanan amar lo kana lokech, Resh Lakish amar kana lokech. Rabbi Yochanan says the sale is invalid, Resh Lakish says the sale is valid. Rabbi Yochanan amar lo kana lokech amar lach, ki katani matnitin machar haben lo kana lokech ad shemut ha'av. Rabbi Yochanan explains that it's invalid because when the Mishnah says that if the son sells it, it's not valid. The sale does not go through until the father dies. But then when the father dies, then it is valid. That's only if the son did not die while the father was alive, that tuli de aben, because then it does transfer to the son. And then, since the son had already sold it, then it can has a mechanism to transfer to the buyer. But if the son dies while the father is alive, then it never goes fully into the hands of the son. And therefore, even when the father dies, that buyer will not get it. That was Rabbi Yochanan's interpretation. The essential principle behind Rabbi Yochanan's opinion is that ownership over produce is like ownership over the land itself. Whoever enjoys usage of it, they have the more important access of the title. Since the father, even though he said, I'm selling you to from now, I'm giving it to now to the son, but still, since he is using and enjoying the produce, so it's as if he still has access and ownership of the land itself. And therefore, when the son sells it, he's selling something that doesn't yet belong to him. And so if he dies first, there is no sale. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish omer, kana lokeach, ki katani matnitin machar haben, en la lokeach ad shemut ha'av, ki mayit av, mi hat'it la lokeach, lo shena lo met, haben b'chaya av, de atu lide haben, ve'lo shena met haben b'chaya av, de lo atu lide, de ben, kana lo lokeach. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, Rosh Lakish, interprets it differently, and he says that the sale is valid. And when the Mishnah, that last line says that if the son had sold it, then it doesn't transfer to the buyer until the father dies. That is true. But once the father dies, then the sale does transfer. That is true no matter who dies first. It doesn't matter if it's the son did not die while the father was alive, in which case the son is alive when the father dies, and so it goes into the hands of the son, and then it goes to the buyer. And it doesn't even matter if the son dies first, in which case the son never fully owned it, never enjoyed the produce. Nevertheless, the sale is valid. The fundamental principle that's based on is al makasabar kinyan perot lav ki kinyan haguftame ki chizabin dide kazabin. Ownership of the rights to the produce is not like owning the item itself, right? And this happens all the time. I own a car, but I let you use it for a month. You don't own the car just because you can use it. And so here, although the father is using is enjoying the produce, it's not like he owns the item itself. The land itself, the son owns the land itself, and therefore, when he sells the land, he has perfect right to sell the land. And so, once the father dies, whether the son is alive or not, doesn't matter, that that sale goes through, and the buyer owns it. Okay, that's the background, the two explanations of our Mishnah. Now, let's apply it to our case here of the mother who transferred the land to her son, and Rabbi Meir ruled one way, Rav Yehuda, based on the statement of Shmuel, ruled the other way. So how do they each interpret it? Ba'anan hashta ben Rabbi Meir baraba ben Rav Yehuda k'Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish sevira lehu. So actually, this machloket between these two judges, Rabbi Meir, who said the son gets the land, and Rav Yehuda, who said no, the husband gets the land, both of them agree with Resh Lakish. So we're not even following Rabbi Yohanan at all, but they're arguing within two interpretations within Resh Lakish. V'kamar b'Irmiya bar Abba, Yisal kadat kinyan perot kinyan haguf dameh. Irmiya says, if you think that ownership of the fruit is like ownership of the item itself, which is what Rabbi Yochanan said, then the consequences would be ki mayit av umayit haben bechaye haav amayit le la lokeach. If the father dies, but the son died first, why should the buyer get it? The father had the right to the produce, so the son selling the land should never go through. Ki kazabin hai lav dide kazabin. When the son sells it, it's not his. Ela lav shema'amina kinyan perot lav ki kinyan haguf tameh. Rather, it must be that ownership of produce is not like ownership of the land. And therefore, Rabbi Meir says, I'm going to apply that same thing, that same principle, to our case. The mother owns land. She owned it from before the marriage. She enters into a marriage with Rabbi Abba. Rabbi Abba enjoys the fruit. Okay, very nice, you can enjoy the fruit, but there's no ownership of the land there. The mother still has full ownership of the land and has a right to sell it. And what she does, she transfers it to her son, and that's a valid transfer. And even if the mother dies while the husband is alive, that sale goes through. And Rabbi Yirmiya says, that's why when Rav Shmuel came, I granted the land to him, to the son. Ahadru lekamed Rav Yehuda. And so the sages brought that opinion to Rav Yehuda. Amar lehu hachi amar Shmuel zo ena domel mishnatenu. And Rav Yehuda's counter to that, he knew all that. He says, yeah, but he's quoting his teacher Shmuel, the early Amora, and said that this case with the mother is not the same as the Mishnah Baba Batra with the father. The cases are not different. Now, what does that mean? My ta'ama. Amar Rav Yosef bishlama I tana ipcha hakotev nechasav le'aviv ika le'mifshat mina dekinyan perot lav kekinyan haguf tameh. Rav Yosef explains what Shmuel meant by saying that this case of with the mother is not the same as our Mishnah. He says, if our Mishnah said the other way around, Then it would be a good proof if it said that a son who owns property writes a deed and transfers the property to his father from now, but the son will be able to enjoy the fruit while the son is alive. So he's transferring ownership to the father, but the son continues to have the fruit. Then we would be able to extract the basic principle that usage of the fruit is not the same as owning the property, because in that case it would be the son who transferred to the father, and the son continues to own the fruit. And then in that case, if the father sold it to someone else and then died, and then after that the son died, so if you said in that case that it transfers over, then we would know that ownership of the fruit, which the son has, is not ownership of the land. And in fact, even though the son owns the fruit, but since the father got the land, so the father has a right to sell it, and the transfer will be valid. In that case, I would be able to learn that principle. But in the way that the Mishnah is actually written, with the father granting the land to his son, maybe the reason why the son has a right to sell it is not because we recognize that transfer, because the son owns it even though the father owns the fruit, but rather because the son is in line to inherit the land. And therefore, the father, since he's going to inherit it anyway, the father is okay with the son selling it even now. But so there's no proof here. It could be that the son has a right to sell it only because he has a right to inherit. Says, yeah, but actually it doesn't matter which way it would be. Are you saying that a son inherits the father, but the father does not inherit a son? If a son does not himself have children, then the father inherits. So actually inheritance can go both ways, and therefore that's really the same thing. Rather, why would a son write a deed that his father should get this land? Could be that this son who owns the land himself does have a son, but he doesn't like him and doesn't want his son to inherit. So therefore, the middle one writes a deed that it should go to his father, the grandfather of the bad son who he doesn't want it to go to. So that's why he's doing that. And here, too, it could be the same thing. When a father grants title to his son in his lifetime, could be that the father has other sons, but he doesn't want the other sons to inherit. So he gives it to one particular son while he's alive and says, listen, I'm still going to use it while I'm alive, but you will inherit it. You will get it after I die. So really the cases are the same. And therefore, that can't be what Shmuel meant when he said that the case of the mother is not the same as our Mishnah. Elamai ena doma le Mishnatenu. Rather, what did he mean when Rav Yosef quoted Shmuel by saying that this is not a good proof? He's saying that to Rabbi Yirmiyah. Mishum takanat usha damar bi yosef bar chena be usha etkinu isha shemachram benikse melog pechaye ba'ala umeta habal mosi miyad halakohot. It's because of an ordinance that was made in the city of Usha. Because Rabbi Yosef bar Chanina says, in Usha, the rabbis got together and they made an enactment that if a wife sells nikse melog, that's land that she owns, and she will get back after the husband dies or after divorce, she gets back the land as is. So she retains ownership of the land, even though while they're married, the husband enjoys the fruit. So the rabbis decided that if she should sell the land while she's married, then she dies, the husband inherits it anyway, and he can go after those buyers. We want to protect the husband. This was part of the marriage deal, that, hey, you're bringing this into this land into it, and then I have a right to inherit. So the husband is expecting that. We don't want him to be cheated out of that by the wife going and selling the land while the husband is right there. So the rabbis say, oh, you can't. If she tries to sell it, we don't recognize that sale. And if she dies first, the husband can go after those buyers. That was a takana. It's for this reason that Rav Yudah said, in the name of Shmuel, that Rabbi Yirmiyah's ruling on the case was wrong, and that a mother who had given the land to her son while the husband was alive, does not, it's invalid, and the husband, Rabbi Abba, has the right to go and take it back for himself from that son, from Rav Shemuel. And that's why this case is different from the Mishnah. The Mishnah, talking about a father granting land to his son, there's no takana in that case, and the father has a right to give it to his son, and the son has a right to sell it to a buyer, and there's no, the father, then after the son dies, and the father dies, then the buyer can keep it, and no one else can take it away. So that's why the cases are different, and that's why Rabbi Yirmiyah was technically correct in making his ruling that because once the mother gave it to the son, really, it she, even though the husband has a right to the for the fruit, but rights to enjoy the fruit are not rights to the property. The mother kept the primary right to the property, and therefore did have the right to give it to the son. So from the letter of the law, Rabbi Yirmiyah was right. However, the enactment from Usha overrode that and said that the husband can take it. Rav Idi bar Avin af anana metenena. Rav Idi bar Avin says we have a braita that supports that there was such an enactment in Usha. Let's say you have two witnesses that come and say, we testify that this husband divorced his wife and he paid the ketubah already. But these witnesses were lying. In fact, they're still married. She's still serving him as a wife. And turns out that they were edim zomin. So now they will have to pay to the wife that which they tried to take away from her. They said that she was already paid the ketubah, but in fact her ketubah was not paid. So how much should they pay? And let's say the amount in the ketubah, it says $20,000, right? In the case, in the event that the husband should divorce his wife or he dies first, then he or his inheritance will have to pay her $20,000. So we don't say that Edim Zomin have to pay $20,000 because we're not sure if the husband would die first or divorce her, in which we would have to pay. It could be that she would die first, in which case the husband wouldn't have to pay anything. So you can't just say it's $20,000. Ela tovat hana'at ketubata. Rather, it's the value of the benefit of the ketubah. In other words, like it's like buying a future where you're not sure if it's going to be paid out or not. How much would you pay for the right to collect the ketubah? It's kind of a bet of who's going to die first. Ezehu tovat hana'at ketubata. What does that mean? The financial benefit of the ketubah. Omdim kama adam roseh liten beketubah shel zo shimnit armela o nitgarisha ve'imeta yirashena ba'ala. We can estimate. How much would you give? How much would you bet? Give to for the right to collect this ketubah should she become widowed or get divorced, in which case the entire amount is paid. But if not, if she dies first, then the husband will get all of her property and there will be no payout of the ketubah. So maybe that's like a 50-50 chance, so that would only be $10,000, or depending on maybe if he's very old or she's very sick or whatever, you could make such a calculation. That's the braita. Now, how can we prove from here that takanav usha v'isakada tachleta letakanat usha amayira shena ba'ala? If there's no takana in usha, then why does the braita end and say that the husband inherits everything? Tezaben ketubata legamre. Let her sell the ketubah in its entirety. In other words, if the woman has a right to sell things that she owns, so she brings land into the marriage, and she can sell the land. So she can sell the land even while she's married, and the husband therefore would not inherit. Why does the Baraita say that they assume that the husband inherits everything that she has when she can perfectly well go and sell what she has, and so the value of the ketubah can in fact be sold in its entirety now. But the Baraita doesn't say that. The Baraita assumes that if she dies first, the husband will get all of her stuff, all of her land. That why? Because the husband can go after any land that she tried to sell, her land that she tried to sell during the marriage, the husband can go after it and take it back from the buyers. So that explains this line. This line assumes takanat usha. However, Amar Abaye, im amiru b'nichse melog, yomiru b'nichse son barzel. Abaye says, even without takanat usha, that assumption that she's allowed to sell land while she's married would only apply to nichse melog, that's land that she will get back as is. She completely controls, because she has complete ownership of that land even during the marriage. I mean, the husband takes the fruit, but she would have a right to sell that land only. But nichse son barzel, that's land that she brings in, that's estimated what the value is, and the husband would then only have to pay her the amount, a fixed amount of the land, which means that she is given a guaranteed amount. Whether that property goes up or down, she's guaranteed. In that case, the husband would certainly have a right to keep it, to inherit that land, and she would not be able to sell it. Therefore, even without takanat usha, this line would make sense that the husband is going to inherit her, because the husband is certainly going to inherit nichse son barzel, and she would certainly not be able to sell her all of her ketubah and everything that she brought into the marriage. That's guaranteed that she will get back in the ketubah. She will certainly not be able to sell that, because even if she can sell nichse melog, she could not sell nichse son bazel. Therefore, Abaye says there is no proof from this baraita for takanat usha. Baruch Adonai leolam. Amen ve'amen.